Good morning, everyone.
Please, everyone, shut off their mobile phones.
We have a seat inside, Lydia.
Your course today?
Maybe join. You're most welcome, yes. There's a seat over there, and there's a seat over there. We've reached book 8, the shortest book in the poem, which has only less than 200 lines. Book 8, the book of death. We read through the whole text last week, and we made a start on the first paragraph, on the first few lines, on page 561. And I mentioned that this brings us back to the second canto of the poem, where Savitri wakes up on the morning when, as she alone knows, Satyavan must die. And sitting beside him as he's still sleeping in the dawn, she recalls her whole life, everything that has led up to the morning of this momentous day. And that whole story, including what happened before her birth, is then recounted in the next 300 pages. And then from book 4 onwards, it's also still flashback, we get the story about Savitri's birth, her growing up, her father sending her out to search for her life's partner, and their meeting in book 5, the book of love, their marriage, and then this intense experience of Savitri's, which is described in the first canto of book 7, the joy of being with Satyavan. This is what she has longed for, and this is brought about. But then, after a short period of unalloyed joy, she remembers what a short time they have together. And it is in that double state of being in bliss when she's with Satyavan and being aware, reminded that she will be alone after his death, that a voice from above calls to her to undertake the search for her soul, which we followed in book 7, which we completed last week. So now we are facing, like Savitri, the death of Satyavan. She's waking up in the morning knowing that this is the day. I think we just read the first 11 lines, so I'll read those again, and then we can start our detailed sentence-by-sentence study. Page 561. I also mentioned last week that this is a canto which survives with very little change from one of the very early versions of the poem, probably from the 1920s. Page 561. Now it was here, in this great golden dawn, by her still sleeping husband Lane, she gazed into her past, as one about to die looks back upon the sunlit fields of life, where he too ran and sported with the rest. Lifting his head above the huge dark stream into whose depths he must forever plunge. All she had been and done, she lived again. The whole year, in a swift and eddying race of memories, swept through her and fled away into the irrecoverable past. Would you like to start, ma'am?
Then silently she rose, and service done, bowed down to the great goddess simply carved by Satyavan upon a forest stone. What prayer she breathed, her soul and Durga knew. Perhaps she felt in the dim forest huge the infinite mother watching over her child. Perhaps the shrouded voice spoke some still word. At last she came to the pale mother queen. She spoke, but with guarded lips and tranquil face, lest some stray word or some betraying look should let pass into the mother's unknowing breast, slaying all happiness and need to live, a dire foreknowledge of the grief to come. Only the needed utterance passage found. All else she pressed back into her anguished heart and forced upon her speech an outward peace.
Thank you. No, please, thank you, thank you. So I think this passage is not difficult to understand. She gets up in the morning, she does the things that she has to do, her daily service, and then she goes and bows down. Satyavan has made a simple carving of the great goddess. And we don't know what prayer she breathed at that moment. She knew, and the goddess Durga knew. And we don't know what Savitri felt. Perhaps she felt she had some sense of the infinite mother watching over her child. Perhaps she heard some voice of reassurance and blessing. So then she goes to Satyavan's mother, the pale mother queen. She has to get permission. She wants to go with Satyavan into the forest on this day for the first time in the whole year that she's been there. But she's very careful how she speaks. She doesn't want to give any indication to his mother that something might be amiss. Satyavan's family do not know about Narad's prophecy. Savitri is carrying that knowledge, that foreknowledge, all alone. It has not been shared with anyone. So at this moment, she doesn't want any stray word or any troubled look to convey to Satyavan's mother this dark foreknowledge of the grief to come, which would destroy for that mother all happiness, all need to live. So Savitri only allows the needed utterance, only the words that have to be said. and all the, her other knowledge and feelings she pressed back into her anguished heart and forced upon her speech and on her face an outward peace. That's what she's been doing this whole year, no? She has not been giving any sign of her dire foreknowledge. Is it clear? Anybody would like to ask anything? Yes, Don.
A question about line 6 and 7.
Yes.
And the question is, why is the word forever there?
This is the sense that perhaps somebody who is dying has, that he's going to be diving into this dark stream of forgetfulness, the river Lethe, or the dark river of time, and that he won't be coming back, at least in the same form. No. It's a river that's going to carry him away from these sunlit fields of life. If we compare these 11 lines with the first page of Canto 2, we won't do it now, but anybody who's interested can make this comparison. We can see that there also there's the image of a river, and there it is, the river of time. And we can get a good feeling of the kinds of changes and expansions that Sri Aurobindo has made from this very, very early version, which we are reading now, from probably early 1920s, and the final version, which he worked on so much in the intervening 30-odd years.
Shabhavan, I have one question. Why Satyavan opened the first stone?
He has carved something. The great goddess simply carved by Satyavan upon a forest stone. So there in the forest there must be boulders, and he has carved an image of Durga on the stone, and that's where Savitri goes to bow down and make her prayer in the morning. Vikas, would you go on?
1 year that I have lived with Satyavan here on the emerald edge of the vast woods, in the iron ring of the enormous peaks, under the blue rifts of the forest sky, I have not gone into the silences of this great woodland that enringed my thoughts with mystery, nor in its green miracles wandered. But this small clearing was my world. Now has a strong desire seized all my heart to go with Satyavan, holding his hand, into the life that he has loved and touched herbs he has trod, and know the forest flowers, and hear at ease the birds and the scurrying life that starts and ceases, rich far rustle of boughs, and all the mystic whispering of the woods. Release me now, and let my heart have rest.
Thank you. Anything to share about these lines?
I have something to share. They do remind me of Schubiner's poem Love and Death.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Schubiner's
poem.
His poem Love and Death.
Which you may remember, we had a beautiful film a couple of months ago of the paintings which Priti Ghosh has made. And we heard the whole poem beautifully read by or extracts from the poem read by Christoph, and saw these beautiful paintings telling the story of love and death, which Schaubindo had written earlier, and which told perhaps a similar story of a young couple living in the forest, and the young wife gets bitten by a serpent and dies, and how the husband goes in search of her and is finally able to bring her back. You saw that, yeah? It's a version of, but it's an Indian traditional tale which Sri Aurobindo has taken. But he later said that he was too much influenced by the Greek idea of the afterlife at that time.
How old was he when he wrote that?
I don't know. Perhaps in his, he came back to India in 21. He might have been in his late 20s or early 30s when he wrote it. In Baroda. Yes.
I am so struck by the idea that they have been so close emotionally, but that she never went into the forest with him.
No.
And so it's a reminder of the culture at that time.
Yes.
She's under the.
She had to.
Mother-in-law.
Well, she had to take care of the parents, the blind father, the old lady, the Satyavan's mother. And we had that lovely description of how she was serving them, bringing the water, sweeping the floor, looking after the fire of altar and kitchen. And, she had been a princess, of course, but she really looked after them like a daughter of a humble household.
But not even being curious about that.
Well, she followed him somehow within. When he was moving around, she could feel an inner connection with him, share some of his experiences. But she hasn't left the hermitage until now. I think this is a feature of the traditional story. And Savitri's position in that household. So how does Satyavan's mother reply? Will you read this? Mm-hmm.
She answered, "Do as thy wise mind desires, O calm child sovereign with the eyes that rule. I hold thee for a strong goddess who has come pitying our barren days. So dost thou serve even as a slave might, yet art thou beyond all that thou doest, all our minds conceive, like the strong sun that serves earth from above." Then the doomed husband and the woman who knew went with lifted hands into that solemn world, where beauty and grandeur and unspoken dream, where nature mystic silence could be felt, communing with the secrecy of God.
Let's pause there. So this is a beautiful reply of Satyavan's mother. She pays tribute to Savitri, who is so young. She says, "You are a child sovereign. You are like a queen, but you are still a child, so young. But still our eyes have the power to rule." And she tells her, "I think that you have been sent from above, that you're a strong goddess who's come to take pity on our barren days." She's been a queen herself, no? But now she's been living in exile with her husband in the forest. A very, very simple life, the life of hermits, ascetics. And the coming of this lovely daughter-in-law has brought a light and sweetness into their lives, which was missing before. And she says, you're serving us just like a slave might, doing every task for us. But I can feel that you are not bound, you are not unfree. You're beyond everything that you do and everything that our minds can imagine. You're like a strong sun serving the earth from its position high above.
Yes.
And a beautiful tribute. So then, Satyavan, the doomed husband, and this woman, Savitri, who knows what's coming, they went together with linked hands into that solemn world of the forest. And they go with different feelings. Sonia, would you read?
Beside her, Satyavan walked full of joy because she moved with him through his green haunts. He showed her all the forest's riches, flowers innumerable of every odor and hue, and soft, thick, clinging creepers, red and green, and strange, rich-plumaged birds, to every cry that haunted sweetly distant boughs replied, with the shrill singer's name more sweetly called. He spoke of all the things he loved. They were his boyhood's comrades and his playfellows, coevals and companions of his life, here in this world whose every mood he knew. Their thoughts, which to the common mind were blank, he shared, to every wild emotion felt an answer. Deeply she listened, but to hear the voice that soon would cease from tender words, and treasure its sweet cadences beloved, for lonely memory when none by her walked, and the beloved voice could speak no more.
Thank you. When Savitri and Satyavan first met, this is one of the things he told her about. His experience of growing up in the forest and how much he had learned from the animals and the birds there and the presences that he felt there. So as Audrey says, Savitri's been waiting quite a long time to share that experience with him. But now she has to do it not in the joyful way that we would have wished for her, but under this shadow of death. She listens to his sweet words with the sense that at any moment that voice will stop and she will not hear it anymore.
May I make a comment?
Sure.
What particularly strikes me about the whole of this passage that we've read so far is the contrast between Savitri, fully human, and yet she's the goddess.
Mm.
And she knows in her heart they are linked forever. And she argues later with death and puts him down for trying to propagate the idea that death is the end of things.
Yes.
But it is so full of the soul having a human experience that it's incredibly powerful.
Yes. I think also this is partly due to the fact that Sri Aurobindo left this book more or less unrevised. As Richard Hartz has written, that he never fully integrated it into the rest of the poem, because of course we have just been reading Only last week we read this amazing last page of Book 7, Canto 7, in which Savitri has become the cosmic spirit and the cosmic consciousness pervading all this, all the forms and beings of this universe, Satyavan's mother says. You're beyond all this. But the main composition of this book took place at a time when it wasn't Savitri, a legend and a symbol. It was Savitri, a tale and a vision. And we have much more of this legendary quality there. And actually it is, as you say, very, very poignant. No? Sri Aurobindo decided that that's enough now, we don't need to change it anymore. And to show at this moment Savitri, the very human side of Savitri, that we see also in Canto 1 of Book 7, where she's suffering so much before she starts her yoga. Probably this passage and those passages were much closer together until he started the great revision much later on.
Mm. I'd like to just add one more thing. Sorry for talking too much.
No, go on, share something else.
Those of you who know of the accounts of Sri Aurobindo's last moments in his human incarnation will know that the very last act that he did was to take Shantaklal to his side and embrace him.
Mm. Yeah.
Kiss him.
Mm. How human is that?
Mm. So we'll read on. Patty, will you read?
But little dwelt her mind upon their sense.
Line 75. Yes.
Of death, not life, she thought, or life's lone end. Love in her bosom, hurt with the jagged edges of anguish, moaned at every step with pain, crying. Now perhaps his voice will cease forever. Even by some vague touch oppressed, sometimes her eyes looked round as if their orbs might see the dim and dreadful gods approach. But Satyavan had paused. He meant to finish his labor here, that happy, linked, uncaring, they too might wander free in the green, deep, primeval mystery of the forest's heart. A tree that raised its tranquil head to heaven, luxuriating in verdure, summoning the breeze with amorous wideness of its boughs. He chose, and with his steel assailed the arm, brown, rough, and strong, hidden in its emerald dress. Wordless but near, she watched. No turn to lose of the bright face and body which she loved.
Mm, thank you.
I'm using an older edition, and there are several lines.
Several lines not there.
Completely different.
Yes.
Could you share them with us?
Being put in. It starts in the same way. Sometimes her eyes look round as if their orbs might see the dim and dreadful gods approach. But Satyavan had paused. He meant to finish his labor here, that happy, linked, uncaring. They too might wander free in the green, deep, primeval mystery of the forest's heart. And after that, there is nothing until wordless but near she watched.
Oh.
So there's several lines
nice.
Have been inserted there.
Yes, it means that the editors of this edition, 1993, what they did when they were doing this big revision, which has culminated in the 1993 version, was they compared all the available manuscripts. And they have found several lines and passages. And last time I mentioned about this title of the last canto of Book 7, The Cosmic Spirit and the Cosmic Consciousness. They had given a title to that canto, but then when they made this comparison leading up to this 1993 revision, they found that there had been a page where Sri Aurobindo had written, and it had just been overlooked in doing the typing. So it was the first time since the 1940s that they went back to the manuscripts, the proofs, and compared the whole text. And there are some such... last week we had... Tara had a similar experience, no, that several lines we read were not in her copy. Norman, would you read?
Her life was now in seconds, not in hours, and every moment she economized, like a pale merchant leaned above his store, the miser of his poor remaining gold. But Satyavan wielded a joyous act. He sang high snatches of a sage's chant that pealed of conquered death and demons slain. And sometimes pause to cry to her sweet speech of love and mockery, tender than love. She, like a pantheress, leaped upon his words and carried them into the cavern heart. But as he worked, his doom upon him came. The violent and the hungry hound of pain traveled through his body, biting as they passed, silently, and all his suffering breath besieged, strove to rend life's strong heart cords and be free.
Thank you.
There's also very powerful animal imagery is here. First the panther leaping and seizing the words, to,
yeah,
dragging them into herself.
Yeah.
The panther drags its prey into its lair. And then we have the hungry
hounds of pain, yeah.
Again, leaping upon Satyavan and biting him. They're very, very powerful images.
Yes. And this irony, no, that
yes,
she's aware that everything is coming to an end. She's treasuring every moment like a miser counting his gold. But Satyavan feels absolutely confident. No? He's so happy to be with her in the forest. And so he's joyously doing his work, and he's singing snatches of a sage's chant that pealed of conquered death and demons slain. These were the things he must have learned in the hermitage, though, these powerful Vedic chants about immortality. And he's mocking her, teasing her, but then suddenly this moment of doom arrives. Suddenly, this young man in his full strength gets struck down. And it happens in two stages. You like to read?
Yes. Then health, as if the beast had left its prey, a moment in a wave of rich relief, reborn to strength and happy ease, he stood rejoicing and resumed his confident toil, but with less seeing strokes. Now the great woodsman hewed at him, and his labor ceased. Lifting his arm, he flung away the poignant axe, far from him, like an instrument of pain. She came to him in silent anguish and clasped, and he cried to her, Savitri, a pan cleaves through my head and breath as if the axe were piercing it and not the living branch. Such agony rends me as the tree must feel when it is
sundered.
Thank you. Sundered and must lose its life. A while, let me lay my head upon thy lap and guard me with thy hands from evil fate. Perhaps because thou touchest, death may pass.
Thank you. This reminds us that Sri Aurobindo was a dramatic poet. He wrote poetic dramas, no? So it's not just done in one stroke. There's a moment of relief, and then the pain comes back again.
I think you can feel some of these lines. At the moment of death, he feels a oneness with the whole of the natural world, especially with the tree that he has been cutting.
Cutting, yeah.
Sort of moment when he and nature are one in their pain.
Yes, thank you. I was surprised actually that he chose a living tree to cut. I think usually when people go into the forest they try to take dead or dying branches, but anyway. He chose a tree, raised its tranquil head to heaven. It's just luxuriating. It's in the fullness of life, just as he is, no? Calling to the breeze with its boughs. No? He just goes and attacks it.
There's also this image of death with an axe.
Sorry, say it again.
Typical image of death is always that death
coming with an axe.
It's very analogical, symbolizing cutting the tree. The tree of life.
So Mother had said, I think that the body of a tree is like the body of a man.
A living tree.
Building our huts, so you need fresh, good trees. Yeah, no, the next coming lines is very subtle. He picks, he sits on the egg.
Yeah, she chooses. Let's read it.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's difficult to cut a dead tree.
It's more difficult to cut a dead tree.
Yes.
Okay.
Since we know the Amazon jungle, these live trees
die on this one.
Alina, will you read? No? Don.
Then Savitri sat under branches wide, cool, green, against the sun, not the hurt tree, which his keen axe had cloven. That she shunned, but leaned beneath a fortunate, kingly trunk. She guarded him in her bosom and strove to soothe his anguished brow and body with her hands. All grief and fear were dead within her now. A great calm had fallen. The wish to lessen his suffering, the impulse that opposes pain, were the one mortal feeling left. It passed. Griefless and strong, she waited like the gods. But now his sweet, familiar hue was changed. Was changed into a tarnished grayness, and his eyes dimmed over, forsaken of the clear light she loved. Only the dull and physical mind was left, vacant of the bright spirit's luminous gaze.
Thank you. Is it clear? Anybody would like to ask anything or share anything? Yes, Manohar.
Why is he saying so much, explaining that she chooses one tree instead of the other? Why, it goes on for a few lines, saying that she leaned beneath a fortunate pinky trunk instead of
I think it's
under the one that he had already cut.
Yes, I think it is, you know, somehow instinctively choosing the best place, the one where there's the best atmosphere, not where this tree has been damaged and hurt, but under a fortunate kingly trunk, a fully grown tree that has not had to be damaged in any way. Perhaps that's a kind of protective, helping presence that she chooses. Yes.
Mm. Perhaps she's in denial a little bit.
Yes, maybe. Yeah. At least, but first there's this impulse to lessen his suffering, to oppose pain. These are very poignant human emotions. He says these were the only human feeling that's left. And even that goes, she knows this is the end. No, that's when the denial passes.
So wondering about that he uses a word dead, or grief and fear were dead.
In her. Huh? Yeah.
Not gone or so, but here the same word.
Marie-Ange, will you read?
That once there before it faded wholly back, it cried out in a clinging last despair, savagely, savagely, oh savagely, bring down my soul and kiss me while I die. And even as a pearly, pearly lips rest his failed, losing that sweetness of response. His cheek pressed down her golden arm. She thought his mouth still with her living mouth, as if she could persuade his soul back with a kiss. Then grew aware they were no more alone. Something had come there conscious, yes, a vast and dire. Near her she felt a silent shade immense, chilling the moon with darkness for its back.
Thank you. What's your question, Marie-Ange?
She was puzzled by my soul, which
no,
I think
no,
is just
no,
a reference to savagery.
That's not what I said.
Mm. That's what you
meant. They have leaned down, I think, leaned down my soul, but they have leaned down, comma, my soul. So I think why comma?
Yes, but because he's speaking to Savitri, no, he thinks of her as his soul, so it's addressing her. Yeah, but we might not always put it. But here, Sri Aurobindo has very clearly and beautifully indicated the rhythm of the line. Lean down, my soul, and kiss me while I die.
And my soul is how he
addresses her.
So there has to be a comma before that.
Where the pauses come in the line are really very, very important for getting the real mantric rhythm.
Yes.
And sometimes Sri Aurobindo indicates them, and sometimes we have to find them for ourselves. Sri Aurobindo was not so stuck on the rules, the classical rules of punctuation. He punctuates much less than the real grammarians would wish, I think. Yeah. I've followed his example, and now I have a wonderful copy editor who comes and puts commas everywhere in my writings. And sometimes I have to say, no, I don't want to comment.
When you're dictating, you don't say when the commas are to be there anyway.
You do it with your voice. Lean down my soul.
Yes. Anyway, so these lines, last lines which Marie-Ange read, these were all in the early version. And now come 18 lines which Sri Aurobindo added in the late 1940s. And in this way he has somehow linked this early writing with what's going to come next. So Paula will read.
An awful hush had fallen upon the place. There was no cry of birds, no voice of beasts. A terror and an anguish filled the world, as if annihilation's mystery had taken a sensible form. A cosmic mind looked out on all from formidable eyes, contemning all that was unbearable, gaze, and with immortal lids and a vast brow, it saw in its immense destroying thought all things and beings as a pitiful dream, rejecting with calm disdain nature's delight, the wordless meaning of its deep regard, voicing the unreality of things and life that would be forever but never was, and its brief and vain recurrence without cease, as if from a silence without form or name, the shadow of a remote, uncaring God, doomed to his naught, the illusory universe, canceling its show of idea and act in time, and its imitation of eternity. She knew that visible death was standing there, and Satyavan had passed from her embrace.
Thank you. So this is how Sri Aurobindo introduces us to this figure of death, one of the major characters in the drama of this poem. It's also one of his major divergences from the traditional legend. In the traditional legend, this is Yama, who is, of course, the god of death, but he's also the god of law and order, of dharma. He's the one who keeps things in their place and recognizes positive qualities. And it's because he recognizes the positive qualities of Savitri and her speech to him in the legend that finally he feels that it is, he admits that her arguments are just and correct and politely worded, respectfully worded, and that he will release, it will be the right thing to do, to release Satyavan. Sri Aurobindo's figure of death is not like that. He seems to be the opponent, the great negativity which denies all positive qualities. It's as if the mystery of annihilation had taken a perceptible form, a form that can be seen and felt. There's a cosmic mind there looking out of these terrifying eyes, which is treating with contempt everything that it sees. All this is worthless, illusory, unreal, without value. It saw in its immense destroying thought all things and beings as a pitiful dream. It's like an embodiment of the eternal no, rejecting with calm disdain nature's delight. The look in those eyes expresses the unreality of things and the unreality of life, which wants to go on and on forever, but in fact has never existed really. It comes and it goes, but it has no permanent reality. So his whole being, it's as if from a silence without form or name, a vast unknowable reality, the shadow of a remote, uncaring God, a God who has no delight in his universe, no care or appreciation of it, is dooming to his nothingness this whole illusory universe, cancelling out its show, its false appearance of idea and act or action in time, an imitation of eternity. This is his first characterization of this figure that Savitri will now have to face through the next cantos. Yes, Paula.
What do you think is the significance of the not speaking for this whole year, not expressing others around her, not knowing that all of the work that she's doing within in preparation for this, but then she has this other level of life where she's beloved, you know, Satyavan is she describes her life there as bliss. That's sort of like holding these two very disparate
states, yes. And perhaps she can do this because she is the bridge, the golden bridge between the darker and the lighter, brighter sides of things.
Also, she might not want to get other people to
know. No, this is the reason that is given, that she doesn't want to share, and particularly particularly to Satyavan's parents, because she knows it would completely destroy them.
And then that there might be a small, tiny hope that Narayan was mistaken, and that would not happen. No?
Even he had said, Satyavan must die, but what else may be, we will have to see, something like that. Yes. And when she started her yoga, she was promised that if you find your soul, you will be able to conquer death. So it's very interesting that in this book, we're taken back to that early version of the poem in which there was no yoga of Savitri. That was added in 1946, 1947. So we get this dramatic contrast between the human Savitri and the ordeal, the terrible ordeal that we see her having to face as a woman. But in the following cantos, we shall see it's as if each of the realizations of her yoga in book 7, one after another, gets tested in the course of books 10, 9, and 10, and even 11. Yes?
Would you say something?
Yes, this is his mind. That's what he is. He's a universal consciousness which is looking out and despising negating everything.
Is the everything individuality? In other words, you're only individual, and then you're not anymore. Is that the distinction?
Well, we shall see. We are going to hear his arguments through the next cantos. We'll learn a lot more about him. We'll also see him gradually changing. So I don't want to go into that too much just now.
Can I have a question? Silence, as if from a silence without form or name. Why silence can be with silence?
Yes, this is interesting, because in this line it's almost as if there's an allusion to the unknowable reality, which Savitri has also experienced. No?
Yeah, this is the positive silence when Sri Aurobindo mentioned silence. I understand
yes.
from that perspective.
But there also, in Book 7, Canto 6, it was as if that silence was dissolving everything. Things might go out of existence. Even Savitri herself might go out of existence. But then she's shown the counterpart of it. It's as if death embodies that negative side. Yeah? Perhaps.
Shraddha,
yes.
You said that the traditional Yama, the image of traditional Yama is upholding law and order, which gives a kind of a positive twist to his personality.
Yes, Dharma, he's a very positive. Yudhisthira is an embodiment of Dharma. No?
But Sri Aurobindo is not holding that view, but when I couple that he's upholding the Dharma with the capital punishment as a stick,
yeah.
then it becomes a totally different...
And we shall see that in these coming cantos, Sri Aurobindo refers to this aspect. He's always in favor of law and fate and the great unchanging order of things. No? But Savitri says, I've come to change all that. I've come to challenge your stony laws.
And the Indian people tend to worship almost everything, including Saturn, but I don't know. In my personal experience, I don't think Indian people worship Yama. There is a temple.
Yes, you do. Yeah, there is a story also.
When you go to Kailash Mansarovar, first you cross the Yamadwar.
That's it.
Like the Nachiketa story?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Like that also. The different stories they worship the Yam. The parents want that their child not be taken care of, not taken by the Yam.
It's rather obviously a divine, a cosmic power, let us say, a cosmic power, death. No?
Do you remind me also, because they say that Kailash is the abode of the God, and you cannot go with your defiled thoughts and bodies over there. So you
have to somehow be purified.
The door of death, and as a symbol of, symbolically they leave some hair or a path or something, as a symbol of leaving their earthly body and going in their immortal soul.
Thank you. Yes.
Just a few pages earlier, we were reading about nirvana and all gaining absolute.
Yes.
And I wonder if this death, this experience of death, or this some kind of personification of this experience or something.
It seems to be like that. And it's because she's passed through that experience of the nirvana and the all-negating absolute that she is able to withstand him. Yes. Her yoga has equipped her to deal with this. And we will see it exemplified step by step. It's remarkable. Shall we stop there for today? We can listen to Mother reading some of the passages from this canto.
silently she holds, and service done, bowed down to the great goddess, simply carved by Satyava upon a forest stone. What prayer she breathes, her soul and daughter know. Perhaps she felt in the dim forest too, the infinite mother watching over her child. Perhaps forest's heart, worldly
insects. He sang high snatches of a sage's charm.
thanks to Sri Aurobindo. I forgot to mention at the beginning a reminder. We've got two special events this coming week. Opening tomorrow in the Square Hall is an exhibition of 45 visionary paintings by Hooter. These are not Savitri paintings. It's over the years from 1956 to 1983, these various paintings were made, and this is the first time that they are being exhibited. So that opens tomorrow, and it'll be open till after the Golden Day on 2nd of March. It'll be closing. And next Friday, we'll be holding the 6th annual Dr. M.V. Nadkarni Memorial Lecture. Jamshed Mavalwala from Pondi will be speaking about the theme of surrender in Savitri, and taking also quotations from other works of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother. He's been making a special study of the three qualities of aspiration, rejection, and surrender, which Sri Aurobindo says are fundamental. And in this talk, he'll be focusing on the theme of surrender. So that's from 4 to 5 on Friday afternoon. Everybody's welcome.